Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Imagine a box. Imagine that inside that box is a Geiger counter and a small amount of radioactive material, and a glass jar of poison gas. Oh, and a cat. Now, imagine that if the Geiger counter detects radiation above a certain mark, its arm moves and breaks the glass jar. Poison gas leaks out, and the cat dies. But since it's a small amount of radioactive material, that may not happen. So as long as that box is closed, you don't know whether the cat inside is alive or dead. And therefore, until you open the box, that cat is both alive and dead. This is the famous thought experiment known as Schrödinger's cat, devised by one seriously pissed off quantum physicist named, yes, Schrödinger, in the 1930s. See, all the cool kids in physics class were saying that particles could exist in several states at once. And Schrödinger, instead of sitting in the back of the class eating paste, used this thought experiment to show them how crazy that idea was. I've been thinking about Schrödinger's cat ever since I heard about the new album Blue, which is a note-for-note recreation of the famous Miles Davis album Kinda Blue. The original is jazz, the new album's by a jazz band, but if it's note-for-note the same, is it alive or dead, jazz or something else? We'll open the box and find out later. We'll also have live music by Shaky Graves, a character who is kind of a thought experiment himself, from the mind of singer and songwriter Alejandro Rose Garcia. But first...
Three, that's a magic number. Three. Yes, it is. It's the magic number.
The English writer Catlin Moran put a New York Times bestseller out back in 2011. It was her memoir-slash-feminist handbook, How to Be a Woman. Now the Times of London columnist is back with another book, but this time it's a novel called How to Build a Girl. Catlin Moran joins me here in the studio to share her Pick 3 playlist. Hi, Catlin.
Hello, beautiful.
Oh, gee whiz. We're off to a great start. Do you find people in America saying Caitlin all the time?
Oh, God, they do in the UK as well.
Oh, okay.
No one in the world pronounces this name Catlin spelled that way, apart from me. I made up my own name when I was 13, and I've been apologizing for its ridiculous pronunciation ever since.
Well, now, your protagonist in this novel, How to Build a Girl, she is in the process of making up a name and making up a person to go along with it. And the person that goes along with her name of Dolly Wilde is a very, you know, sort of tart-tongued music critic. So this is clearly based at least in part on your own experience.
Oh, totally. I mean, the split between the fiction and the non-fiction in this book is that is the same as it is basically in Little House on the Prairie by Laura Ingalls Wilder. Like, Laura Ingalls Wilder was a pioneer girl. She went across America. But a lot of those specific instances that she writes about in those books didn't actually happen to her. They were things that she'd researched or had happened to friends. So it's the same with me. Like, this is a book about a fat, teenage, working-class, self-taught girl who becomes moves to London, becomes a rock critic, sleeps with a lot of people. That was me. That's Johanna. But
That wasn't research.
No. Well, a lot of the individual sort of incidents and penises that happened to Johanna didn't happen to me. They happened to friends or acquaintances.
Okay. And Johanna, is it Johanna?
Yes.
Okay.
As in visions of.
So she becomes Dolly Wilde, and she starts writing for a fictional magazine that seems to be based on Melody Maker.
Yes.
The late Melody Maker.
Well, the Was actually exists. She writes for the Disco Music Echo, and The Was, which is called The Dame, that's his nickname.
Yes.
And there was actually a magazine called Disco Music Echo. My husband's a rock critic, and he collects old magazines and rock press and makes our entire house very dusty in a massive fire trap. And so this newspaper in real life was discontinued in about 1967, but I kind of liked the idea of keeping it alive for the novel.
Hmm.
So yeah, she goes and works there, and it's a place full of crazy misfits, as anybody who's ever worked for a rock magazine will know. It's basically like the cantina scene in Star Wars. Wars. Kind of like the, those are the kind of people who become rock
a
critics.
A more wretched hive of scum and villainy.
Exactly, yeah. A shallow money trench, etc., etc. And so, yeah, so she rocks up there and they're all weird, but she's kind of the weirdest one of all. She's like a 16-year-old virgin wearing a top hat because Slash from Guns N' Roses wears top hats. And she tries to show off to the big boys and it all goes very wrong.
So it's the 1990s and so she finds herself in the midst of the Madchester craze.
Yes.
Britpop is forming, Blur and Stone Roses and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And she quickly finds out that, you know, if she writes positive reviews, that can be a problem. But if she writes negative reviews, she becomes like a star.
Yes. Well, as a, the first thing she writes, are kind of, she is a fangirl. So she's writing all the stuff about the bands that she loves. And her editor, who's quite a sort of waspy man, just goes, no, you're writing like a fan. If you want to get ahead, get a hate. You know, that's the stuff that kind of makes people read. As now on the internet, you know, the stuff that was that is clickbait is usually kind of negative rather than positive. So she sort of crushes her enthusiasm, turns herself into sort of a sort of sarcastic, cynical person, and then realizes, as so many young people will realize on the internet themselves, that if you sort of put yourself out there pretending to be a kind of angry person when you're actually really enthusiast, it will at some point come around and bite you on the arse.
Yeah.
You know, if you're projecting yourself as being a cynic and being angry, people will start being cynical and angry at you. And suddenly you'll be like, but I'm not a horrible person. I save worms when I find them on the pavement when it's rainy and they're drowning. Kind of like, I was just pretending to be horrible. But of course, you know, only really an ass would pretend to be an ass. That's kind of, let's all just be truthful about our love.
The book is called How to Build a Girl by my guest Catelyn Moran, the author of How to Be a Woman and the columnist for the Times of London, who's here with us on Soundcheck, sharing a Pick 3 playlist. And your first pick is Stone Roses, who would have been very much in the air.
Yes, they were huge, kind of like sort of when that first album came out, I was 15. And, you know, I come from a very working class, poor background. And kind of during the 80s in the UK, the story was that basically Margaret Thatcher had come along and crushed the working classes. We kind of, you know, there'd been strikes and riots and we'd been kind of crushed. And the Stone Roses came along and they were a working class band. They were incredibly proud of it. And that kind of sense of euphoria and kind of just, they had a real sense that the working classes are different to the middle classes and better. We are the people that forged the Industrial Revolution. We are the people that formed the Beatles. And the Stone Roses tapped into that working class heritage and pride. Plus, I really fancied their guitarist, so it was a perfect storm.
The song is I Am the Resurrection from the band Stone Roses.
Down, down.
The Resurrection from Stone Roses. That song is mentioned, Catelyn Moran, in your novel, How to Build a Girl.
Yes. Well, this is the... In the UK, we had this amazing legendary show called the John Peel Show Late at Night on the BBC. And that was... It was a place that you would go and meet fellow like-minded people. That show would broadcast out late at night and every kind of kid who was part of the counterculture or the underground would lie in bed on the headphones listening to Uncle John Peel playing you all these songs and you felt like you weren't alone. It was like an imaginary nightclub in the sky that you could go to even if you were just wearing your pyjamas in bed in your parents' house. And you know, that's so when she first listens to John Peel for the first time, that's her discovering the counterculture, this kind of, this idea that, you know, the idea of an underground is a physical place that you can drop past kind of what's in the charts at the moment, like Duran Duran, and drop down into this magical world where there's kind of Sonic Youth and Stone Roses and, you know, kind of, and just go, this is my world, these are my people.
Right. John Peel, for American listeners who haven't come across him, for decades,
yes,
was the guy who kind of broke the new bands, but he also listened to world music and occasionally jazz and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the kind of thing, you know, now these days when you say to someone, what music are you into? And everyone goes, oh, a bit of everything. Kind of, you know, that was not the case up
right
until about 10 years ago. He was the first guy who really was into everything. And every band in Britain that formed would send him their record. I mean, he literally had every record that came out in our country and kept them and listened to every single one, would be the first one to play things. Nirvana did so many early sessions for him, kind of like he broke them in our country,
mm-hmm,
before they even broke over here. Like, kind of, you know, he was an amazing man.
Yeah. And not a cynic. Now, before we heard the Stone Roses, you talked about Johanna, or Dolly Wilde, as her byline goes, sort of devolving into this well of cynicism.
there's a moment late in the book where she kind of realizes what is wrong with cynicism. And it's like two pages of spectacular writing on what is wrong with cynicism, and especially cynicism among the young.
Well, yeah, this, I mean, one of the sort of starting points for writing this book was kind of, you know, I basically live on the internet. I live on Twitter. This is where I hang out. And just I'd noticed this sort of growing trend in young people online. Because the thing is, in this book, it's the early 90s, and she becomes a rock critic at the age of 16, so she can publicly broadcast her thoughts. She has an audience. That was a very rare thing to be able to do in the early 90s. But now everybody, because of the internet, very young people can have put their thoughts out there. And I'd noticed this thing that sort of when young people start communicating, because they know they're young and they feel they've got to cover it up, they think that a way to look older is to become cynical and to become sarcastic and snarky and kind of down on things. And that does a terrible thing to your soul when you're young, to become cynical at that age, because it kind of calcifies you and restricts you. It's like you're wearing a kind of very tight black carapace to protect yourself. But that restricts you, it makes you tiny. That kind of cigarette smoking, no, I hate everything, everyone's an asshole. You know, that will do your soul no good at all. You need to have the bravery to be the person who runs into a room and goes, life's amazing, I've just eaten a baked potato and I love Crowded House, hurrah! You know, trying to be cool will kill you. You know, it will make you very, very tiny. Always be brave enough to be a joyful fool, I think, is that the message of one of the messages of the book.
And so Joanna discovers these, like, different, the three main kinds of music.
Yes.
And the third kind is the one that gets through that carapace, that cuts through, and that is from America.
Yes. Well, it was an amazing time to be a girl in the early 90s, kind of like, you know, Riot Girl was just starting to happen, you know, and as a teenage, you know, as a fat, very friendless, very weird, sort of over-self-educated teenage girl, when I found out about Riot Girl, it just blew my mind. It was like, there's a whole bit in the book where she's just going, they're making different kinds of girls in America, new kind of girls, girls like you, girls who would like you. And so, you know, the first, I can remember, you know, for me, the first time I heard Courtney Love and Hole, it blew my mind, because Courtney came from a weird hippie background like me, but she didn't care. She was fearless, or at least pretending to be fearless.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had a massive poster of her on the wall. I loved her and worshipped her so much. And same with Bikini Kill, when, you know, Rebel Girl came out. The lyrics of that are so great, because, I mean, it starts off, she's describing a girl, a rebel girl, and it sounds like she's sort of bitching about her and is slagging her off. And then it gets to the chorus, and it's like, rebel girl, you're the queen of my world. She wants to wear the rebel girl's clothes. She wants to sleep with her. And the way that girls fall in love with other inspiring girls is such a beautiful thing and so underdocumented. So yeah, in the book, she basically falls in love with the Riot Girls and wants to become one.
As you did?
Oh yeah, so much. Like, yeah. I mean, to describe to your listeners what I'm wearing, I'm still dressed exactly like I was in 1992. I'm wearing a pair of Doc Martens, ripped black opaque tights, a plaid shirt and a pair of cut-off denim shorts. And, you know, and I'm back home in my hair and wearing cheap black eyeliner, and I really haven't changed since the days when Kim Deal stalked the earth.
So you're still a Riot Girl?
Yeah, always. And I think everybody always is still a teenage girl inside. Even,
well,
boys.
I'm going to get in touch with my inner teenage girl here as we listen to Bikini Kill. Riot Girl movement of the 90s, that's Bikini Kill with their song Rebel Girl. Soundcheck listeners, if you want to learn more about Riot Girl, go to our website, soundcheck.org. It's part of our How to Be Smarter series. We did a whole segment about the Riot Girl movement. Catlin Moran, the English author, is with me here on Soundcheck today. How to Build a Girl is the name of her new novel. And the idea that, you know, just a couple of people here and there, little pockets of people writing, singing, saying the right things can change the world. That's another one of the great moments in this book where Johanna comes to that realization.
Well, this is one of the key things, like, kind of, you know, I didn't go to school, I was home educated, and so everything that I've ever learnt was from going to my local library and reading, and from my pop heroes. One of the big characters in the book is John Kite, who's this kind of rock star, and I wanted to write about a rock star that I'd never seen before, because all the rock stars I've seen in popular culture are kind of skinny blokes in kind of, like, black leather trousers wearing sunglasses who talk in a Cockney accent, smoke their fags and just fall over and shag a lot. And that really insults me as a fan and all the other fans that I know, because all the rock stars that I loved were brilliant autodidacts who were kind of centre points of information for me. They would be in interviews talking about the Situationists and Guy Debord. They would be cluing me into the kind of music they loved. They would be talking about architecture and fashion and politics. Amazing band in the UK called the Manic Street Preachers, who just talk about, you know, the start of the trades union movement in the UK and kind of, you know, and sort of politicised the whole generation. And so I just wanted to write about a rock star like that, like the ones that I know that do change things, that do become an information point, particularly if you live in the middle of nowhere and your parents aren't particularly cultured. A good rock star can come along and change your life. You know, you will look to them for information. You know, they will be your connection to the outside world. And the whole process that Dolly Johanna goes through in the book is that thing when you realise you're not enough, your parents may not have made you what you need to be. Mm-hmm. And so you build yourself. And you build yourself out of your heroes and songs and lines from poetry and from what you wear and the makeup you put on your face, and you build yourself. And, you know, nearly every teenager I know is self-loathing and self-doubting. And it's that brilliant moment where you go, well, look, if I hate myself, I'll make a new self. And the minute you have that thought, life starts to become fun. You become your own project in your own game. And everything that you go out and find and see and touch and have sex with becomes part of this brilliant part of collaging yourself.
And hence the title, How to Build a Girl. But, of course, you don't build a girl in the course of 250 pages. So this is the first of a trilogy?
Yes, the first of a trilogy. This one's How to Build a Girl. We see how she kind of makes herself. In the second one, it's called How to Be Famous. I want to write about fame and creativity and about working class culture. And also, in this book, she has a lot of bad sex in this. This is the bad sex book. In the next book, I wanted to have good sex because I want to write about... I just want to write about sex. I think it's a very difficult time to be a teenage girl. You know, kind of like, you know, there's so much explicit pornography out there. Yeah. And you so rarely see joyful, creative, amusing sex, and sex that's got anything to do with women. Kind of like, sex seems to be something that men are having at women and on them. And, you know, Dolly's a girl who definitely wants to go out there and have sex and has her own ideas. So she'll be having a lot of good sex in the second book. And the third book's called How to Change the World. Because mm-hmm. she goes on to form a new political party and foment a revolution. I want to write a handbook to fomenting the revolution.
So there's a little foreshadowing of that in this book at the moment where Dolly starts thinking, you know, if you had just killed the right 200 people, I would not be living in a different world from my father.
Absolutely. Kind of, it's a brilliant thing to kind of, you know, if you feel like you're part of an oppressed minority, which I think all women do, anyone of colour, anyone of a different religion, to go back and see how quickly a couple of people can change history and will improve other people's lives. You know, in the UK, so my politics really firmed up when I had my first daughter when I was 24 and I nearly died in childbirth. And the only reason I didn't die is because we have the NHS, you know, which was
National
created
Health
by
Service,
the National Health Service, which is free medical care, who saved me, who performed an emergency operation for no money and saved me. And because the reason that I have access to that is because a couple of guys came up with this idea and enacted it in Parliament, and because a couple of women got together and made sure that I had the vote and that I would receive equal medical treatment to men, which was not the case before. So that was the point where I just went, you know, it probably is 20 people in the past who have changed my life and have saved my life and mean that I'm alive now. And if in some small way I could be one of the people who went out there and, you know, changed some other people's lives, I would like to sign up for that revolution, please.
All right. So Dolly has that in her future in
book
three.
This is what she'll be doing. Yes.
Book one is How to Build a Girl. It does stand entirely on its own. This is not a question of life or death, but, you know, you do write in the book about the first time she walks into a record shop.
Yes.
And that seems to be very much, you describe it as the treehouse with the no girls allowed sign.
Yes. No, I mean,
is that still the case?
I don't know now because...
I mean, are no record shops anymore, are there?
Exactly. I mean, and walking into Spotify, I don't think is quite as threatening. But no, it definitely was, you know, in the early 90s when I walked into a record shop, I was very aware that not only were there no girls in there when I walked in, but probably no girls had ever walked in there and that there was probably alarm going off around the back, just kind of going, weird, estrogen has been detected. And to talk about music, like, I think girls do talk about music differently and kind of, you know, and the way that we respond to stuff. And, you know, particularly in those days, to talk about music and why you liked it as a girl would mean that you would have a load of men standing around just going, well, I don't think that's true. And also sort of the stuff that's naff, like, you know, kind of like then I was a massive fan of ABBA. Now, they've had a revival recently and kind of it's cool to go. They are an amazing songwriting, you know, a duo, the equal of Lennon and McCartney. But then they were just seen as, they were seen as a girls band. They were for girls and gays. And to say that you liked ABBA would just mean you'd be laughed out of town. And so I always, so, you know, and I think girls are much bolder, you know, kind of like the stuff that we think that is naff is actually the stuff that I think will be proven to stand the test of time. kind of like, you know, we're less involved in what's cool. We just respond. We just like stuff that makes us dance and makes us happy. And that is the purest response of all, I think.
And whereas guys sit around and talk about the turnaround where the seventh chord comes in. And
exactly. And I can nerd out, you know, until the end of time. You know, I can sit here and compile a list of my favourite drummers of all time now. We can talk about Omar Hakim until the cows come home. But kind of you
very
also...
Very good. Yeah, Omar Hakim.
Thank you very
nice.
Much. Right. But, you know, but you also have to be able to just be honest and just go, yeah, if I had two drinks, this would make me dance on a table. This is, and that is the purest response of all.
All right. So who these days would Dolly Wilde be dancing on the tables too, do you think?
Oh, Robin. She would be hugely into Robin.
The Swedish pop star.
Yeah, Swedish pop star. It's all about heartbreak and stuff, but disco. And, you know, the boys would think that was naff, but she would stand up for it. She would love FKA Twigs. I don't know if she's happening over here yet.
A little bit. Beginning. Yeah.
Who's amazing. There's an artist called Kate Tempest in the UK, who's like a rapper and poet and sort of political activist, who's just this brilliant, kick-ass bad lady.
Yep, we've had her here in the studio.
But she would also love Daft Punk, you know, kind of, you know, she would be very conflicted about Lady Gaga at the moment. She would have started off loving her, would kind of be worried now she might have lost her way, kind of.
Yeah.
She'd she'd love Rihanna, she'd love Beyonce. You know, it's an amazing time to be a woman at the moment. There's so much incredible stuff out there.
Do you miss being a music critic these days?
I like the idea of going back to it in my 50s, you know, kind of like the sort of, there's a very famous female music journalist in the UK called Julie Burchill, who started at The Enemy when she was 16 as well. And she said, I had to give up being a music journalist at 24 because it's, you know, I felt too old. It felt ridiculous doing it past the age of 24. But I quite like the idea of coming back to it in my 50s, just kind of the point where you're really not supposed to be, you know, as a woman. And by that point, I'll look like an old witch, like a wild woman of Wonga with a huge amount of grey hair, just suddenly down the front at gigs again, scaring teenage boys.
But still in the Doc Martens and the cut-off
always.
Jeans.
I've chosen my outfit. Yeah. I live in this outfit. I die in this outfit.
We're speaking with Catlin Moran. She is the New York Times bestselling author of How to Be a Woman. Her new novel is called How to Build a Girl. And she's been sharing a little playlist, a pick three playlist with us on Soundcheck today. And the third pick, the thing we'll end with, is Crowded House.
Yes. Or as we say in the UK, Crowded House.
Crowded House.
Well, this is really good. This kind of taps into what we were saying now, kind of like about being truthful about, you know, what's seen as naff. You know, still, I don't know about here, but like in the UK, Crowded House, people just think, oh, that's sort of M.O.R. pop. But if you talk to, you know, Bruce Springsteen thinks that Neil Finn from Crowded House is the greatest living songwriter. Paul McCartney, you know, he will just doff his cap to Neil Finn. And I think in 10 years' time, everyone will be going, yeah, I was always into Crowded House in the same way they do about ABBA now. And the reason I particularly love Crowded House is that I met my husband when we were both working at Melody Maker, and you know, if that was a place where, you know, everybody would just be off to see Skinny Puppy that night, horrible industrial bands. And the point where I realised I was probably going to marry my husband was when he took me into one corner and went, I've got to tell you a secret about me. And I was like, what? He went, I'm really into Crowded House. And I went, I am too. And we were the two people who were into naff, old, melodic, beautiful, brilliant, talented Crowded House, and that was our dirty secret.
Well,
so always be proud to love the naff things that make your heart swell.
Not the Girl You Think You Are is the name of the song, which seems absolutely apropos to the character of Johanna Morrigan / Dolly Wilde in this book.
Well, totally. Well, when my husband played me this song for the first time, he went, this song is about you, because it was the point where I was still trying to be legendary and bitchy and kind of hot. And he just went, you know what, that's quite exhausting. Why don't you just be nice instead? And I was like, yeah, I could do that. And so I've just spent the last 20 years with him just being nice instead.
Catlin Moran is the author of the book How to Build a Girl. I'm still debating whether I'm going to give this to my daughters to read.
Oh, please do. The best way to do is leave it lying around. Tell her she's not allowed to read it because it's dirty, and then she'll read it.
That's a good. I may take you up on that. Catlin, it's been great having you with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you, darling.
He'll take you places in his car that you won't forget. No. All the people let you know, yeah, will turn their heads as you go by.
you'll be hard to recognize.
Coming up, the Austin-based guitarist and songwriter known as Shaky Graves joins us to talk about where he got that awesome name. Then he plays some of his awesome music here in our studio. And later, the jazz staple Kinda Blue gets kind of remade. This is Soundcheck.
Oh, they'll sink like stones into their homes away from teeth like mine.
Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer. The Austin, Texas-based singer and songwriter Alejandro Rose Garcia performs as Shaky Graves, a name that he debuted with a self-released album a few years back. The album was called Roll the Bones, and it has remained one of the best-selling digital albums in the history of the music site Bandcamp. Now, the second Shaky Graves full-length album is out, or coming out. It's called And the War Came, and it expands on Shaky Graves' sound in ways that you will now hear in the Soundcheck studio, because here is Shaky Graves with a live performance of If Not For You.
Thank you.
That is Shaky Graves live in the Soundcheck studio and his song called If Not For You, which will appear on the new Shaky Graves record, And the War Came, which comes out on October 7th. Shaky Graves is the performing moniker of Alejandro Rose Garcia, guitar, voice, the suitcase drum,
yeah,
and Chris Busada playing our more conventional drum kit. It's not just a suitcase that you've turned into a drum. You've turned it into a heavy metal drum because you got the two kick pedals.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, I've thought about getting the double or smoke machines or some sort of laser setup that would come out of it. That's kind of the phase two.
And even more unusual is, you know, when I read that you did this, that you were the one-man band thing with mm-hmm. the suitcase drum, I naturally assumed you would maybe sit behind the suitcase yeah. and hit the kick pedals the way most drummers do. You're standing in front of it and playing these things with the heels of your feet.
Yeah.
How do you even do that and not, like, lose your balance?
It's so much easier. You wouldn't even believe it. I used to do, because I never really set out to be a one-man band. That wasn't, you know, what I went to college for or anything like that. But
there's no major for that.
No, I don't think so. But the first time I did it, you know, it was just jumping on someone's drum kit and eventually, I was just a huge pain in the butt because I didn't have a car at that point or a drum kit. So I would be like, you know, hey, friend, dear friend of mine, you want to drive to my show? Maybe pick me up, you know, on the way and bring parts of your drums for me to destroy. And so eventually I had a really close friend of mine make this prototype. And he's a drummer and a total wild man himself. And originally, I used to sit on top of it. That was kind of how it was set up.
Like the South American cajon, the
sure,
box.
Exactly. Yeah. And so he came up with this cool rig, you know, essentially this whole thing. And we didn't really know how it was going to turn out. And he just sort of ran away with it. And one time I got too drunk off of a really bad margarita and stood up at a show. Like, hey, look at me. And it changed. It changed everything. You know, it changed the dynamic. It changed my performance. It was a lot more enjoyable.
Any face planting happening when you were first learning how to do this?
No, okay, I hurt my heels a couple times acting silly, but no, it's a pretty safe drum, you know.
And is it a working suitcase when you're traveling? Can you put the rest of your stuff, clothes?
You kind of can't. Yeah, okay. I mean, all of it goes inside of itself, you know.
Okay,
and
well,
so
good.
We put it on airplanes and people throw it around and it's an old lady at this point. We've got its knees all taped up.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. So now, you've done act. I mean, you know, you had a recurring role in Friday Night Lights.
I did, yeah.
And, you know, a couple of Robert Rodriguez films as well. Is Shaky Graves for you a character when you came up with that name? Was there a guy who went with that you now inhabit?
Yeah. I mean, as much as anything, you know, I mean, Shaky Graves can be, for instance, you know, when I'm playing with Chris, that's still Shaky Graves, and I can still be Shaky Graves at the same time. But it really is like, at its best, it's a really good writing tool.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just gives me, I guess, a lot of bravery in the sense that I would do things that me, myself, I don't think I could take full responsibility for. I mean, I haven't killed anybody yet. I haven't died. I haven't.
But Shaky's done all that.
But Shaky can do whatever he wants. You know, he can be a canoodling, philandering, panhandling weirdo, you know? And I can go home and sleep in my bed and wear a bathrobe and stuff like that. That's great.
Do so you want to play another song for us?
I'd love to, yeah.
This one's called Hardwired, and once again, a performance from the artist known as Shaky Graves, a.k.a. Alejandro Rose Garcia, playing his guitar, his suitcase drum, and singing with Chris Busada behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio. The album is called And the War Came, and it comes out on October 7th. We're getting to hear some of the songs today here on Soundcheck. Also, Shaky Graves will be performing on Friday, September 26th, this Friday, at the Beacon Theater, opening for the Tedeschi Trucks Band. And then Shaky Graves back here in New York at the Bowery Ballroom on October 26th. Let's hear this live performance of his song called Hardwired.
Well, water was wine back on Blue Mountain time while I watched your loving expire while I lay in close.
close to you as the lace on the shoe. And that's when I knew we were hardwired. Oh, well, you bumbled like bees, and I boiled like the seas. Yeah, well, you led where no one would follow. Yeah, so I hid in the mud of my Catholic blood and let that minute hand raise towards tomorrow. Well, but you are as you came, all sleepless and cocaine. Yeah, just a match, oh, begging for fire. So baby, sit by the still. Oh, drink up your fill. Yeah, tell all of them people your problem. Yeah, well, those friends were so true when you were 22. Well, and now you've got nothing in common. Cause they are as they came, all sleepless and cocaine. They're just a match, oh, begging for fire. I say brace for good times. Yeah, oh, do what feels right. Oh, and send me the bill when you're tired. Yeah, cause I am as I came. Oh, and I'll still be the same. Cause I got nothing to blame.
Once again, Shaky Graves, live on Soundcheck. The song is Hardwired. You can listen to our full session with Shaky Graves over at soundcheck.org. Shaky Graves is a pretty good nickname, but nowhere near as good as the moniker given to Miles Davis, Prince of Darkness. Up next, we'll hear about a really interesting take on an old and very famous Miles Davis record. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the background, you're hearing some of the solo from the Miles Davis song All Blues from his landmark 1959 album, Kind of Blue. Except this version isn't Miles Davis. It's from a note-for-note recreation of All Blues by the New York City jazz group called Mostly Other People Do the Killing. It's on their new record, Blue, along with reproductions of the rest of the tracks from Kind of Blue. Mappa Elliott is the bass player and band leader for Mostly Other People Do the Killing, and he joins us in our soundcheck studio. Mappa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you've made a record, and you've made a kind of what physicists call a thought experiment.
Yes, it is. It is definitely that. Only it is also real.
it is real, as we hear. The big question is why?
Well, we started dealing with the idea about 10 years ago, and it seemed like at first it was just a thought experiment, and we were thinking about directions that jazz had been taking circa 2004, given the kind of parallels people were trying to draw between jazz and classical music and challenges facing jazz education and the idea of creativity versus traditionalism, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We kind of ran with that for a while and came up with this idea of, you know, the logical extreme of that, you know, traditional way of performing jazz would be to exactly copy a jazz record. And there is no better jazz record to do that to than Kind of Blue for a lot of reasons. And so it was a thought experiment for a while. And then we kept the idea kept coming up. And I was intrigued more and more by all of the other things that it would do if it was real.
Mm.
And here's where you
go where the physicists didn't dare to go. I mean, Schrodinger's cat. Schrodinger didn't actually like put a cat in a box and wait for it to either die or not die.
Right.
You actually went and put your thought experiment into practice, which must have taken a huge amount of work to transcribe every detail, every note of every solo.
Yeah, we started transcribing, I want to say, like the winter of 2010, so 4 years ago.
So let me play for folks the first 30 seconds of Miles Davis's solo from the opening track, So What? And then we're going to crossfade the second 30 seconds are not from Miles, but from your band, from Mostly Other People Do the Killing. This is from the opening track of both Kind of Blue and the new album, Blue. Mappa, did you hear the moment where we switched from the Miles Davis original to yours?
Absolutely. but if I can't tell the difference, it'd be a serious problem.
Now, you said that when you first, again, the band is Mostly Other People Do the Killing, band leader and bassist Mappa Elliott here with me on soundcheck. Blue is a note-for-note recreation of the classic Miles Davis album, Kind of Blue. And you said that when you first finished all the transcribing and went into the studio and tried to record it, it didn't work. Why?
Well, the most interesting thing about this whole project for us is the fact that it's impossible. And so once you actually start doing it, you realize that, well, you realize it's impossible pretty quickly. But the reason it's impossible is all of the stuff that makes music great.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible because you can't sound like John Coltrane or Miles Davis, as we just heard, no matter who you are, no matter how hard you try. And, you know, we're all fairly highly educated jazz musicians who've been doing this for a long time. And, you know, it's immediately clear you're never going to be able to do that. So then the question is, how close can you get? And, you know, it turns into kind of like whack-a-mole, where every time you solve one problem, four more pop up. So we initially were going to try to independently record all of the parts and then put them together. But not having the rhythm section in the same room together doesn't work. We transcribed like click tracks to like, but you know, it's a live album. They speed up and they slow down all the time, blah, 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 blah. So the first attempt did not work out. And then we had to re-record it all in the same room live. So what we're hearing there is the rhythm section is recorded live all at once, and then the horns were overdubbed at a later date.
Mm-hmm. So everyone's got a transcription of their part.
Right.
But that's just the notes. If you're trying to do a recreation of the album, you have to get the timbre, the inflection, all the little...
Right, that's all the stuff that's interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, the notes are the least interesting part of it. And so if you look at, especially my transcriptions, but also especially the horn players, you know, the notes are there, but so are all kinds of other indications as to whether it's a little ahead of the beat and whether it's a little behind the beat, or whether, for me, in my case, you know, which notes does Paul Chambers play out of tune? Why did he play them out of tune? Like, is he shifting? Or is there some finger pattern that's happening? I tried to, like, hear where he was shifting, and kind of it became also then this really interesting, like, bodily experience, like, where you're physically experiencing playing the music as closely as you can to the way they were. It's a never-ending rabbit hole to go down.
Now, you know, people will hear this and maybe they'll think it's a joke of some kind, you know?
That would be sad.
Well, I mean, when they see on paper
right. That
a band has done a note-for-note recreation, and then when they see that the band is called Mostly Other People Do the Killing...
Yeah, I can't really do anything about that at this point. well, it's definitely, you know, in no way a joke. If it was, you know, if it had just been a thought experiment or a joke, it wouldn't have been worth doing live. The reason
right.
it was worth actually executing was that the actual product, end product, asks a whole lot of really interesting questions about what music is, how we listen to it, especially what jazz is, why
yes.
it's important,
yes.
you know, and that's what we're interested in.
Well, now, the what jazz is a very big question, and this does raise that question in a very provocative way. But let me first ask you the other question that you just mentioned that this project raises, which is, how do we listen to music? You know, how do we, the audience, listen to you, the band, in your best effort to recreate a piece of improvised music?
Well, in this case, if you're talking about specifically listening to Blue, the thing
I
that...
I am.
That, okay, good. The thing that jumps out and should jump out to the listener are the differences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really highlights what aspects of music are impossible to copy
mm-hmm.
and brings those to the fore. And those are also the things about music that are the hardest to talk about. You know, like... in five words or less to describe Coltrane's tenor saxophone sound. And, you know, there's no way to talk about that. It's much too complicated. Or the Cannonball Adderley's phrasing. Or Miles Davis's breathy mute thing. And so those things are so specific that the fact that we can't recreate them brings out kind of the magic in those.
Mm-hmm.
And then also you get a glimpse into little things about us. And the way that we deviate has to do with the way we play. And so there are certain things about the way John Arabagon plays the saxophone that there are times when it sounds more like Arabagon than it sounds like Coltrane because he can't completely escape
right.
himself.
Right.
You know.
And he's also doing Cannonball Adderley's
yeah,
parts,
he
right?
Does, he does both saxophones, yes.
Wow. Yikes.
He wins prizes. We all give him a hearty handshake and a pat on the back.
Oh, man. So the listening process here might be slightly more detail-oriented. But then it gets to the question of, you know, what is jazz? Because what you're describing sounds to me a lot like the difference between the New York Philharmonic playing Mozart's 40th and the Vienna Philharmonic playing Mozart's 40th, you know, where it's the same piece. I know what's coming next, but if it's a good performance, there will be something that makes me listen to it fresh, anew, you know?
Right. And so obviously our album Blue is not jazz. As one of the, and to a lot of people, the defining characteristic of jazz is the presence of improvisation. But part of the interesting thing that it does is bring up that parallel where, okay, so this is note for note the same, but there are these subtle deviations. And if we're talking about music, historical music now, as a text, and in the classical world that text has notated properties,
mm-hmm.
and in the jazz world that text is an audio product, some kind
a record,
of recording.
Yes.
It's still multiple interpretations of the same text. And so in a certain sense, if you want to get into interesting rhetorical worlds, our album is jazz, because if you play it for someone who doesn't know the process that went into it, there's nothing there that automatically eliminates it as jazz.
Right, right.
And then you're left with that it's multiple interpretations of the same text. But it does bring up the idea of, you know, if we're going to be making jazz music, which is what we usually do. This album is kind of an anomaly for us, obviously. And I'm very invested in the idea of jazz as like a vibrant, viable music. We need to think about why it's viable and important, how to make it more viable and important. And part of that gets to this issue of what is our relationship to history? You know, should we, as jazz musicians, move into this kind of curatorial role where we are
jazz as museum piece
where we are preserving historical music, which this album is the logical extreme of, and I don't personally like that, but other people may come to different decisions. Or should we focus on all of these subtleties and nuances, which are the real, you know, meat and potatoes of jazz music, and stop worrying about whether or not we're playing the chord progression correctly and what notes we're playing, and really kind of champion people's individuality more?
Well, so it really, the album really does raise a lot of almost philosophical questions about music. Mappa Elliott is with me, the bassist and band leader of the group Mostly Other People Do the Killing. Their new album, Blue, is a note-for-note recreation of the Miles Davis record Kind of Blue from 1959. And the band is playing October 15th at Shapeshifter Lab, and November 9th is the actual album release show at the Cornelia Street Cafe here in Lower Manhattan. Let's hear a little bit of Mostly Other People Do the Killing and their version of another tune from the album, Kind of Blue. This one is Freddy Freeloader. Freddy Freeloader. That is another track from Miles Davis's album Kind of Blue, except you weren't hearing Miles Davis's album Kind of Blue. You were hearing the new record Blue, which comes out October 14th, from the New York band Mostly Other People Do the Killing. Where did that name come from?
We band formed in about 2003, and that name has been around the whole time. I pulled it from a quote by Leon Theremin. At an electronic music convention in New York City in the early 80s, someone asked him what life under Stalin was like, and he responded that Stalin wasn't so bad because mostly other people did all the killing, which was, you know, a dark and hilarious thing to say. And I underlined that and was like, that's a good band name right there.
Good band name for like an indie rock or maybe a speed metal band. For a jazz group, it probably has raised more than a few eyebrows.
It has, but I like the idea of all bands, including jazz bands, having names that are somehow reflective of what they do. And, you know, the Mappa Elliott Quartet doesn't quite pack the same punch.
Mappa Elliott is the bassist and band leader for Mostly Other People Do the Killing, here with us on Soundcheck. The album is called Blue, and when you guys play it live, will you try and play it as on the record?
I am fairly certain we are not going to play it live, because the playing of it live is a totally different thing.
Yeah, you know, as it was for the Miles Davis
band.
Right,
you know, those songs do not sound the same when they play them live either.
Absolutely.
And so this project didn't really have anything to do with us attempting to perform it live. It had to do with us attempting to kind of recreate this text.
Yeah.
So, you know, those tunes may creep into the repertoire slowly but surely, but yeah, we're not going to explicitly pull out our 12-page transcriptions and get page turners up on stage with us.
All right, that's one thought experiment too many, huh?
Yes.
Well, the band, Mostly Other People Do the Killing, will be at Shapeshifter Lab on October 15th. That's a Wednesday night. And the album release show will be November 9th here in Manhattan at the Cornelia Street Cafe. The album Blue, a recreation of Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, is out on October 14th. Mappa Elliott, thanks so much for sharing it with us on Soundcheck.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, Inherent Vice is the name of the new Paul Thomas Anderson film, making its world premiere at the New York Film Festival next weekend. It's based on a book by the famously reclusive author Thomas Pynchon, and it's absolutely packed with musical references. Tomorrow we'll unpack a few of them with writer and critic Rob Sheffield. Also on the show, Judah Friedlander. He's the slacker dude with the trucker hat in the NBC sitcom 30 Rock. He's also been in a Dave Matthews music video and acted in films like American Splendor and Zoolander. Most importantly, he's a very funny stand-up comedian, and he joins us tomorrow with a Pick 3 playlist and talks about his fondness for ping pong. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff, with help this week from Alex Kappelman, Amy Pearl, and our interns, Bailey Constas and Cooper Mackey. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.